We want to enrage and frighten him, because angry, scared men make mistakes. The next person we go after is a local police officer who happens to be Henderson's childhood friend. Jimmy Gander, age 55, is one of the oldest cops on the force, and when we grab him outside his favorite bar, he manages to slug Anton in the face before we knock him out. "I'm going to fucking kill him," Anton mutters as we pull into the woods where we intend to interrogate our captive. "Bastard's going to get it." "No killing unless necessary," I remind him. "We're just going to rough him up some if he doesn't cooperate." Anton scowls. "Fuck that shit. I'm going to have a black eye."
"Shouldn't have let Grandpa get the better of you," Jan says, smirking. "Maybe we should have him take your place on the team. He certainly seems more skilled."
"Shut it," I tell the two of them as our SUV stops in a forest clearing. "You can slug it out later." We drag the cop out and wait until he comes to before starting to question him. Like the others, he seems genuinely bewildered by the situation. However, unlike our other targets today, he refuses to answer our questions at first. To Anton's joy, we end up having to hit him a few times before we hear the usual "don't know anything" and "haven't heard from him." Under other circumstances, I would admire Gander's loyalty to his friend, but given that we have less than 2 hours left to question the two remaining people on our list, the delay merely frustrates me. "Put a fucking bullet in him," I tell Anton when the cop balks at telling us about the last time he saw Henderson, and Anton gladly obeys the order, shooting Gander in the right shoulder. After that, there's no more withholding of answers, just verbal vomit and pleas for a hospital. "Let's go," I tell the guys, when I'm confident we got everything we can out of the cop. "Tie him up and leave him here." As we drive away, I make a mental note to call 911 and tell them the man's location when we're safely in the air. Henderson's friend or not, there's no reason for the cop to die. We're on a time crunch now, so we expedite the process by nabbing our last two targets and interrogating them together. We left them for last because they're even more distant connections of Henderson, so if we hadn't gotten to them for some reason, it wouldn't have been a major loss. The first guy is Henderson's daughter's ex-boyfriend, Bobby Karsten. He's 20, some 3 years older than the daughter, and according to our files, they broke up when he slept with her best friend at their high school prom. I can't abide cheaters, so we rough up the kid a little as we question him, a move that ensures our last captive, Henderson's son's favorite teacher, is cooperative from the start. In fact, Sam Breyers is so verbose in his answers about Jimmy Henderson that we get something we didn't expect, a possible lead. "And then they vacationed in Thailand 5 years ago, and Jimmy was saying how much they loved the local culture and all the fruit and how they wanted to live there. There was a local family that they really bonded with in Phuket. Not in one of the touristy areas, mind you, but deeper inland, away from all the crowds. Jimmy was telling all his friends in class about it, and then there was Singapore, which Jimmy's mother always loved because of how clean it is, and there's Iceland, where Jimmy's parents were going to go for their anniversary, and there's Maryland, where Jimmy's sister was going to go to school, and I can think of more if you just give me time." The teacher is speaking so fast he's practically babbling, so we let him talk, jotting down notes on the places he mentions so we can check them out later. We've looked at most of these locations before, including Thailand, but the Hendersons had been moving around to avoid detection, and we didn't know about that local family in Phuket. It's certainly a lead worth exploring. 10 minutes pass, and the teacher shows no sign of running out of steam, his verbosity undoubtedly fueled by the wails of the bruised ex-boyfriend. At this point, he's just repeating himself, going in circles with everything he knows about the Hendersons. So I nod to Ilya, and he taps him lightly on the ribs. "Enough," I say, when Breyer starts screaming like that gentle tap broke his ribs. "Tie them up and leave them here. We have to go." As we drive to our plane, I watch for signs of pursuit, but we make it there without incident. The operation is officially a success.
We've sent Henderson a message and obtained a possible lead in the process. I should feel good, but as the wheels of the plane lift off the ground, all I can think about is that I'm no closer to getting what I really want. That I'm still months away from reclaiming Sarah.
Chapter 24 Sarah. He did what? I stare at Ryson, my palms damp with sweat, and my heart hammering. My first reaction, joy that Peter is alive and well, is being quickly replaced by a painful knot in my stomach. He assaulted 6 people in North Carolina, the agent repeats. 2 are hospitalized with gunshot wounds, and the other 4 are bruised and traumatized by a violent interrogation. Innocent citizens all. Anything you can tell us about the incident? What? I shake my head to clear it of the gruesome images. Why would he do this? According to the victims, he wanted to know the location of an acquaintance of theirs. One Walter Henderson III. He has the misfortune of being on the same list as your late husband. Ryson crosses his beefy arms. It seems that Sokolov is resorting to more extreme measures to get to this man. Anything you can tell us about that? About what he's after? I swallow the bile rising in my throat. Over the past couple of months, I'd somehow managed to forget the brutal reality of the man I've been missing, to gloss over the darker parts in my memories. You don't know? I told you, much of his file is redacted. Ryson uncrosses his arms and leans in. Dr. Kobakis, you know as well as I do that this man is lethal. He needs to be stopped before more innocent people get hurt. It's important that you tell us everything you know about him, so we can have a better idea where he might strike next. I stare at him, feeling alternately hot and cold. He didn't tell me much of anything. That's what I've been telling the agents, and I have to stick with the story, no matter how sick I feel at the knowledge that Peter is hurting innocents in his quest for vengeance. In any case, even if Ryson knew about the massacre of Peter's wife and son, it wouldn't change anything. Peter won't stop until he finds Henderson and crosses him off his list. And as he vividly demonstrated in North Carolina, the feds are still no match for him and his crew. Peter and his men entered the U.S. undetected, assaulted 6 citizens, and left. He was in the same country as I, and if Ryson hadn't decided to question me, I would have never known. My stomach tightens further, and to my horror, I realize I'm not just upset about the pain and suffering he put those people through. I'm also hurt and mad that Peter didn't come for me. We were just a few states apart, and he didn't come for me. Dr. Kobakis. Ryson peers at me intently. Are you all right? Yes. I ball my hands under the table, letting my nails dig into my palms. The hint of pain steadies me, enabling me to say in a semi-normal tone, I'm sorry. It's just a lot. And it is. It's too much, in fact. Until this moment, I didn't fully comprehend how messed up I am, how those months with Peter have twisted me, skewing my sense of right and wrong. Here I am. Having just learned that the killer I've been obsessing about hurt 6 innocent people, and I'm upset that he chose them over me. That he didn't abduct me when he clearly had the chance to do so. I'm sick. It's obvious to me now, as is the fact that Peter may never come for me. All along, vengeance has been his true love, his real obsession, and whatever he felt for me didn't last, if it was even there in the first place. I don't know why I'm still being watched, or if I even am. That itchy feeling may well be paranoia, but it's clear that I'm no longer his priority. I somehow endure the rest of Ryson's interrogation, answering his questions on autopilot. And when I get home, I pick up the phone and call Dr. Evans, the therapist who helped me before. It's time to rebuild my shattered life. It's time to accept that whatever Peter and I had may be over.
Chapter 25. Peter. We spend the next 2 months following up on the tie lead. It's not easy to figure out which local family the Hendersons befriended, and when that doesn't bring us any closer to our target, we take a job in Russia, where an oil oligarch wants us to eliminate one of his business rivals. It's not as lucrative of a gig as some of the others, but the location makes it worthwhile. We haven't been in our home country in years.
Does this feel as weird to you as it does to me? Anton asks as we walk past Red Square, and I nod, knowing exactly what he means. Walking down these streets and hearing Russian speech all around us is a lot like going back in time. The last time I was in Moscow was when I killed my supervisor, Ivan Polonsky, for helping with the Darievo massacre cover-up, seemingly a lifetime ago.
Do you miss it? I ask Anton, and he shrugs.
Nah. I mean, it's not exactly fun to always be the foreigner, but I've gotten used to it. And thanks to Sarah, my English has improved, so...
He stops, his gaze turning wary as he realizes what he just said.
That is, while we were... Enough. My neck muscles are painfully tight and my hands are clenched into fists. But my voice is soft and even as I repeat, that's enough.
Anton wisely shuts up, and we walk the rest of the way in silence. He knows he's forbidden to talk about her, and it's no longer just about her safety. Sarah is a trigger for me these days, so much so that the mere mention of her name is enough to make me homicidal. The gaping wound left by her absence isn't healing. It's festering. I ache for her every second of every day, and I fucking hate it. The daily reports only make it worse, because it seems as though she's forgotten me. Last month she got another job, joining two older OBGYNs in their practice, and she moved out of her parents' house into a new apartment. I'm glad about all of that. I want her to be happy. But for the past 6 weeks, she's also gone out every weekend, drinking and dancing with her friends. On top of that, she started singing with a band on Friday nights, a development that pleased me until I saw a recording of her performing in a sexy dress and realized every man in the audience is drooling over her. They watch her like a pack of wolves slobbering over a hare. If I were there with her, I could have stopped that. Rearranged a few faces, if need be. But I'm half a world away, and it eats at me. More than that, it raises the possibility that Sarah might have forgotten me so completely she might fall for another man, maybe even one of the idiots who come up to her after every performance to gush over her and beg for her phone number. The only thing that keeps me from ordering a hit on those assholes is that so far she hasn't gone out with any of them. It's only a matter of time, though. I know that. The longer I'm gone, the more likely it is. And that is why, right before we took this job, I finally ordered a message delivered to her. She should get it shortly. In the meantime, we have a very rich and very corrupt man to kill.
Chapter 26. Sarah. Sarah, Sarah, Sarah. The chanting of the audience, combined with the deafening applause, is like a shot of heroin into my veins. I'm so high, I feel like I'm flying, and I bow, laughing, as the chanting intensifies. My bandmates, Phil, Simon, and Rory, are bowing alongside me. The audience, though, seems focused on me. Probably because the guys changed the name of the band from The Rocker Boys to Sarah and the Rocker Boys last month, completely ignoring my objections. For whatever reason, Phil decided that the band is much more marketable with me as the lead singer, and every poster now prominently features my face in addition to my name. Last week, I actually had a patient at the clinic recognize me as That Sarah and request my autograph. A highly embarrassing incident that resulted in the clinic staff nicknaming me The Celeb. This is the first time we've done a larger outdoor venue, and I wasn't sure we'd be able to pull it off. Though it's almost May, the weather is still unpredictable. And up until 2 days ago, we didn't know if it was going to be 50 degrees and raining, or 70 and sunny. It ended up being somewhere in the middle, 67 and partly cloudy, and we got a great turnout. Our goal was to sell at least 100 tickets to cover the venue costs, but judging by the number of enthusiastically clapping spectators, we sold close to 4 times that amount. We finish bowing and do one more song as an encore before leaving the stage. As always happens after a successful performance, it's hard to come off the high, so we go to a nearby bar to celebrate and unwind. Like me, my bandmates do this as a hobby. Phil, our guitarist, is a math teacher. Simon, the drummer, is a freelance writer. And Rory, our bassist, works in a call center. Unlike me, however, all three of them would like to do this as a career. And as often happens after a great performance, they immediately start talking about going on tour. "We could start in Seattle, then make our way down the West Coast," Phil says, picking up his beer. His blue eyes glitter feverishly in his ruddy face. "From there, we could go all across the Southwest and..." "Fuck Seattle." Rory knocks back a shot of tequila and slides the glass toward the harried bartender. "We go straight to California, San Francisco, then L.A. It's the best for artists like us, not to mention the weather and the culture and the food." He continues, gesticulating wildly as he talks, and I grin as I notice several women openly staring at him. With his freckled face, unruly red curls, and a bodybuilder's physique, Rory looks like a cross between Little Orphan Annie and an Abercrombie model on steroids. It's a combination that shouldn't have worked, but it does. And I suspect the success of our band owes as much to his looks as it does to our combined talent. Not that Phil and Simon are bad-looking. Simon, in particular, reminds me of a young Denzel Washington, only with a punk rock vibe. Phil is a bit more average, with a receding hairline and a hint of a beer belly, but his outgoing personality more than makes up for any physical shortcomings. All three of my bandmates are attractive in their own way, and each has hinted, at one point or another, that he'd like to take me out. It's too bad all I can see when I look at a man these days is that he's not Peter. The guys don't know that, of course. They're happily oblivious to the terrifying mess in my past, and the FBI agents who still stubbornly follow me around. All my bandmates know is that I'm a widow, and they think grief for my dead husband is the reason I don't date. "How long has it been?" Phil asked sympathetically when I joined the band back in February, and I told him my husband passed away about 1.5 years earlier, having never awoken from a car accident that left him in a coma. Phil expressed his condolences and has tactfully avoided the topic since, as have Simon and Rory. In fact, after carefully letting me know that they were interested, and just as carefully being turned down, they've completely backed off, and have taken to treating me as some kind of saintly figure, an untouchable Madonna encased in a bubble of grief. They're not far off, only the loss I'm grieving has little to do with George, who's fading more from my memories each day. At this point, it's been over 3 years since his accident, and even longer since our love suffocated under the weight of his addiction. Each time I think about him now, all I remember is how I felt when I found out about his double life as a CIA agent, about the secrets and the lies that brought Peter to my door. I wish I could forget him as well, but it's impossible. Though it's been nearly 6 months since my captor brought me home, I think about him every night as I drift off to sleep. Sometimes, I'm convinced I can feel him. Not next to me, but somewhere out there, reaching across the continents to torment me. His pull both magnetic and lethal, like the gravitational force of the sun. I dream of him too, of the tender way he'd hold me when I cried, and the brutal way he'd fuck me. Of all the big and little things that make up the contradiction that is Peter. At times, I wake up from those dreams aroused and frustrated. But more often, I find my pillow soaked with tears and my arms wrapped around my blanket to stave off the agonizing loneliness that keeps me frozen inside. I need to move on, I know. And I try. I go out with Marcia and the girls every weekend, and when a particularly attractive guy asks for my number, I give it out more often than not. but that's where it ends for me. I can't take the next step and actually agree to the date when they call or text me. Why even bother giving it out, then? Marcia asked last week, when she learned that I did it yet again. Why not just turn them down on the spot? I shrugged, not knowing what to say, and she let it drop, not wanting to stress me out. Like most of my acquaintances who've heard the FBI version of the Peter story, Marcia has been treating me like I'm made of crystal and might shatter at the slightest pressure. I think she, along with others at the hospital, thinks my ordeal was even worse than I disclosed. One time, when Mom was still in the hospital, I overheard two nurses talking about how I escaped a sexual slavery ring and am still dealing with the aftermath of being forced into prostitution. It's aggravating. But the only way to address those rumors would be to tell the truth, and I'm not about to do that. Fortunately, my new co-workers don't know anything more than my bandmates. Doctors Wendy and Bill Otterman, the married couple who own the small OBGYN practice, were so impressed by my resume and academic credentials that they barely asked any questions about the 9-month gap in my work history. I told them I took a hiatus to travel around the world, and they hired me on the spot, with the caveat that I start immediately, so they could take a long-awaited cruise to Alaska for their 40th wedding anniversary. I could have looked for better paying, more prestigious opportunities, but I accepted the offer right away, and started the next day. With Mom barely out of the hospital, I wanted something fairly low-key, so I could still keep an eye on her and Dad. But what really clinched the deal for me was the office's location. A 15-minute drive from my parents' house, and a short walk from my new apartment.
Earth to Rory.
Simon waves his beer bottle in front of Rory's face, interrupting his oration on the wonders of California.
Let's just be real here. Sarah, are you going to go on tour with us?
I smile and shake my head. No can do, sorry. Work won't let me take off for so long.
See?
Simon triumphantly surveys his bandmates, as though he's won a bet.
She's not going. It's not happening. Oh, come on.
Phil grabs the beer from Simon and finishes it off in two gulps before motioning to the bartender to bring more. Turning to face me, he gives me the full dose of the famous Phil Hudson charm.
Sarah, sweetheart.
His voice turns cajoling.
We all have work and other responsibilities. But opportunities like this come once in a lifetime. We're catching fire, I can feel it, and we have to seize the day. You have to seize the day, because you know what happens tomorrow?
I shake my head, grinning. I've heard versions of this lecture from him before, and he gets more creative each time. No, what?
Exactly.
He wags his index finger, teacher style.
You don't know, and neither does anyone else. Life is but a series of random events, one that seems to have a pattern but doesn't. You may think you know what tomorrow will bring, but all it takes is a change in a single variable, and boom, off you go in a totally different direction.
Like on a tour, I say dryly, and both Rory and Simon laugh.
A tour, yes, that would be a new variable, Phil says, undeterred. But it's one that you would introduce. Most of the time, the new variable comes from where you least expect it, and then all your carefully laid plans go to shit. Shit? Is that an official algebra term? Did I just learn math?
Rory asks, scratching his curls, and we all burst out laughing as Phil rolls his eyes, muttering under his breath about ignoramuses and drunk assholes. I have to run, I tell the guys apologetically as the laughter dies down. Early day at work tomorrow.
No worries, we know.
Simon pats me on the shoulder.
You go do what you gotta do, and leave these idiots to dream of fame.
I laugh, shaking my head as I walk out of the bar and head to the parking lot in the back. I had my doubts about joining the band, but it turned out to be the best decision ever. Not only do I feel like I was born to do this every time I'm up on that stage, but my bandmates are a lot of fun. I actually prefer hanging out with them versus Marcia and the girls. It's less pressure somehow. I'm pulling open my car door when I notice it. A piece of something thick, folded up paper maybe, taped to the inside of the door handle. My initial reaction is to pull it out and immediately take a look, but some sixth sense stops me. The itchy feeling between my shoulder blades, the one that's so omnipresent I barely notice it anymore, is far more intense all of a sudden, and instead of yanking out the object and staring at it, I unobtrusively pry it loose, hold it in my closed fist, and get in the car. Slipping the object, now definitively identified as a piece of folded paper, into my jacket pocket, I pull out of the parking lot and head home. Behind me is the inevitable FBI tail, and as I drive, the paper feels like it's burning through my pocket. It takes everything I have to park in front of my apartment building and walk through the lobby to the elevator calmly, without hurrying. It's possible that this is some kind of advertisement that's just weirdly placed, but somehow, I'm certain that it's not. Stepping into my apartment, I lock the door and glance around. I don't think there are any cameras or listening devices in here. After all the high-tech equipment found in my old house, and then months later in my parents' house, the feds sweep my place on a semi-regular basis, and they themselves would need a warrant to do that kind of invasive surveillance. However, just to be on the safe side, I kick off my shoes and walk toward my bedroom closet, maintaining my calm demeanor the entire time. If someone is watching me, I'm not going to give them reason for suspicion. My one-bedroom apartment is fairly small, with a tiny kitchen and a cramped living room, but it does have one nice feature: a spacious walk-in closet in the bedroom. I go in there, as I normally would to undress, but instead, as soon as I'm out of sight of any potential cameras, I take out the paper from my pocket and unfold it, my hands shaking. It's just a couple of lines, scrawled on the thick paper in sharp, masculine handwriting. "Remember, Petichka, for as long as we're both alive."
Chapter 27, Peter. The Moscow job goes smoothly. We eliminate our target in one short week, and then we're back to hunting Henderson while we await word from Novak. Last month, the Serbian arms dealer confirmed everything is on track for the original 8-month timeline, but he still closed-mouthed about his asset within Esquerra's organization, the key piece of information I need to implement my plan. Unfortunately, Henderson remains as elusive as always, so as May progresses, we do another round of shaking down his acquaintances for any leads. This time, we focus on his wife's connections in her hometown of Charleston, just to switch things up. "Nothing again," Ilya says with disgust as we board the plane, having interrogated our 5 targets. "The idiots didn't know a thing." I shrug and take my seat. It was to be expected. I still consider the operation a success. We got away without so much as a car chase. And we again showed Henderson that nobody in his life, no matter how remote a connection, is safe. Sooner or later, it will sink in, and then he'll make a mistake. Maybe his wife will get worried about a friend of hers and reach out to check on her, or maybe the teenage daughter will freak out and call her ex. No matter what happens, the moment they fuck up, we'll be ready, and my dead wife and son will be avenged. It's the beginning of June when it finally happens. I get an email from Novak that he wants to meet next Wednesday. "Just you," the email reads. "No one else." I suppress a surge of savage joy and begin making the arrangements. For the past 2 weeks, we've been staying in our Polish safe house, waiting for Novak to reach out. So Wednesday morning, I have the guys drop me off in Belgrade and assume their positions. They won't be with me, but they'll certainly be around. I meet Novak in the same cafe as before. As I walk in, I notice that his goons are conspicuously absent, as are the pretty baristas. Novak himself is sitting at the small table in the middle of the cafe with nothing but a brown leather folder in front of him. "All alone?" I ask, trying not to let my surprise show, and Novak's thin lips curve as he stands up and comes around the table to greet me. "I thought we could dispense with all the bullshit." His pale eyes gleam as he shakes my hand.
We need each other, and I think it's time we built some trust. I'm certain this is bullshit. His men are likely positioned as strategically as mine, but I let my stony expression soften slightly as I release his hand. I couldn't agree more. Good. He sits back down at the table and motions for me to do so as well. Please. I take a seat and assume an impassive expression. So, is the asset in place? Novak nods, maintaining his smug little smile. She's on the way to Esquire's compound as we speak. My pulse speeds up. Time and date of the asset's transport. This is already something I can use. Congratulations. That's quite an achievement, I say, keeping my voice even. Novak accepts the praise as is due. Thank you. It took a lot of work, but I did it. So tell me about her, this mysterious asset of yours, I say. He drums his pale fingers on the table for several long seconds, then says, Are you familiar with the financial structure of Esquire's organization? I stare at him. No, not particularly. I was his security consultant, not financial advisor. This is not where I was expecting Novak to go. Could the asset be someone connected to Esquire's portfolio manager? I know the guy resides somewhere in Chicago, but I don't see... So you don't know that legally and practically, Esquire's wife is his business partner and stands to inherit everything in the event of his death? No, but it wouldn't surprise me, I say slowly. Even back then, when I was still working for Esquire, Nora, the American girl he kidnapped and then married, showed an unusual aptitude for her husband's business. Novak smiles again and opens the folder in front of him. Yes, the young Mrs. Esquire is quite something, isn't she? Finished Stanford at the top of her class. He takes out a photo and lays it in front of me. It shows Nora in a voluminous graduation gown accepting a diploma from a university official. Her smiling face is half-turned, looking elsewhere, but even from this angle it's obvious she's ecstatic. When was this taken? I ask, puzzled. If Novak's people were close enough to take that photo, they must have been close to Esquire himself as well. The Colombian arms dealer wouldn't let his wife out of his sight for longer than a minute. A couple of months ago, at the spring graduation ceremony, Novak answers. Pretty, isn't she? So small, yet so strong. His voice is unusually soft as he says this, his touch almost caressing as he takes back the picture and places it in the folder. I lift my eyebrows, waiting to see where he's going with this. Did he somehow develop the hots for Esquire's petite wife? It's odd, but stranger things have happened. Closing the folder, he looks up. I know what you're thinking, he says. Why didn't I have him taken out right then and there at that ceremony? Why bother with you when I had a shot at him back then, all on my own? I incline my head. The question did occur to me, but I assumed Esquire's security was tighter than your possession of that photo indicates. Novak's lips stretch in another thin smile. You're right. The security was impressive. Still, if I really wanted to, I could have attempted it. I would have sustained heavy losses, but there's a small chance I could have gotten through. But you didn't want to risk it. Oh, I would have risked it. If Esquire's death was all I wanted. Now we're getting to the core of the issue. You also want her. I nod toward the folder. Is that part of it? Novak's pale gaze hardens. Yes. But not the way you think. You see, Nora Esquire is not just a pretty face. She holds the keys to Esquire's kingdom. If I kill him, she simply takes over and I have a new enemy to contend with. One with nearly unlimited resources and a very personal grudge against me. This is getting interesting. So you want them both eliminated. That was my original thought, but no. You see, Esquire is smart. Much smarter than most in our business. Nearly all of his holdings are legally titled, and everything is buried behind layers upon layers of shell corporations. If both Esqueras are killed, it will take me years to untangle the mess. And while I will have achieved the elimination of a rival, I won't have access to what I really want. His business holdings. Yes, that's exactly right. He leans forward. I don't just want Esquera gone. I want what he has, his wife included. I cock my head. So you want Julian Esquera killed, but his wife kidnapped? Yes, and not just his wife. His smile is chilling. You see, she's useless to me without some kind of leverage. Leverage? You mean something like a family member? Yes, precisely. And not just any family member. I need someone she'd do anything for, even embrace her husband's killer. My face remains unchanged, but my blood turns to icy sludge. Is this a roundabout hint that he knows about my obsession with Sarah? If so, I'll kill him on the spot, his hidden goons be damned. If he so much as threatens her, I'll peel his fucking skin off and... You see, Novak continues, oblivious to my rising rage, I need Nora, and I need her completely under my control. I consider using her parents for that, but it might not be enough. After all, parents usually sacrifice for their children, not the other way around. I rein in my bloodthirsty thoughts. What do you have in mind, then? He might not be talking about Sarah. At least he fucking better not be. Going on the assumption that he's not stupid enough to threaten me so obliquely, I decide to take him at face value and say, as far as I know, other than her parents, Nora doesn't have... Yes, exactly. As far as you know. Novak leans back, clearly enjoying his moment of superiority. You and all the rest of the world, a select few people excluded. I stare at him, my thoughts jumping one fact to another. Your asset, I say slowly. The 8-month timeline. Are you saying that Esquera has a child? Yes. His bland face animates. A daughter, in fact, born last Tuesday in Switzerland, some 2 weeks ahead of schedule. Elizabeth Esguera, Lizzie for short. Pretty name, no? Yes, very, I manage to say. My heart is threatening to erupt from my ribcage, and under the table my hands form into fists. A baby. A fucking newborn. That's his plan, his asset. He's right in that it would be the perfect way to control Nora. A mother would do anything for her child. She'd give up an empire and her own life if need be. It shouldn't matter to me. Esquera is no friend of mine, but for some reason the involvement of an infant makes Novak's plan downright obscene to me. It makes me glad I was going to double-cross the fucker all along. But wait. He mentioned that his asset would be able to assist in the hit. That means the child is not it. However, is it a nanny? I ask evenly. Your asset. She's connected to the child, isn't she? Novak nods, his hand flexing on the table in front of him. Yes, but not a nanny, he says, his expression smoothing out. A pediatrician, one that comes highly recommended by the Swiss clinic doctors Esquera favors. Of course. I suspected Novak might have some connection to that place. You bribed the clinic staff. I tried, but sadly no. He sighs. They're so frightened of their patients that they're next to impossible to bribe. I had to hack into their computers instead. I see. All the pieces are falling into place now. That's how you knew about Nora's pregnancy so early. He nods. Esquire brought her there to be examined as soon as she missed her period. And as soon as they knew, I knew, and I reached out to you. I suppress the urge to reach across the table and break his neck. Maybe it's because I know Nora, or maybe it's because when I think of infants, I picture my son at that age. But the mere notion of a newborn being used like that makes me ill. Keeping my tone steady, I say, so you want me to kill Esquera, kidnap Nora and her baby, and bring them to you, So in one fell swoop, you'd eliminate your biggest rival and gain control over his holdings. Novak's smile is all teeth. Exactly. That's very clever. I inject an admiring note in my voice. If you just took Nora and the child to control Esguera, he'd find a way to fuck you over and get them back. He's done that before. But his wife, his widow, I should say, will be easier to handle, especially with a baby to keep her in line. Are you planning to make it legal with her? Yes, of course. Marriage is the easiest way to bypass all those pesky ownership hurdles. I will adopt the daughter as well. And raise her as your own. He shrugs. More or less, any children I breed with Nora will obviously take priority. But as long as her mother behaves, I have no intention of harming the child. Very generous of you. He either misses the sarcasm in my voice or chooses to ignore it. Yes, I think we'll all benefit in the long term, as will you. 100 million will go far in assisting with your little vendetta. I'm not the least bit surprised that he knows about that. Yes, it will, I say without blinking. Good. Do you already have an idea of how you'll go about getting into Esquire's compound? Yes, I say, and look him straight in the eye. I'm going to reach out to Lucas Kent and have him bring me to Esquire. I'm going to tell him that I want to bury the hatchet, and that I'm willing to reveal a traitor to make that happen.
Chapter 28 Sarah. I don't sleep all night again, and by morning, I'm so exhausted I all but crawl to the kitchen for coffee. If today was a work day, I would have had to call in sick. However, it's that most rare of all days. A Saturday, when I have absolutely nothing scheduled. If this was pre-PN, Peter's note, I might have gone to the clinic to help out for a few hours, or surprise my parents by popping over for breakfast. However, this is post-PN, and between the lack of sleep and the ever-present anxious waiting, it's all I can do to plop on the couch and turn on a cooking show. I've been watching a lot of those lately. They remind me of Peter. As always, when I think about him, my mind starts going in circles. It's now been 8 months since he brought me home. 8 months, during which my only word from him was that note. 2 months ago, pre-PN, I was more or less convinced that his obsession with me faded, and that despite his vow, he might never come back for me. Now, however, I don't know what to think. If he still wants me, why am I here? What is he waiting for? Mom is now completely well, or at least as well as she'll ever be. Her left arm is still weak, but she's able to move her fingers and can use that hand to pick up light objects, a much better outcome than initially feared. She's also walking without assistance, and has been puttering around her garden ever since the weather improved. Dad is ecstatic about her recovery, and they're both looking forward to their anniversary cruise in September, a gift I was finally able to give them. As Mom's health improved, and the novelty of my return wore off, my visits with them have gone from a daily to a weekly occurrence. My parents are always glad to see me, of course, but they also value their independence. My dad, in particular, takes pride in being self-sufficient, and I don't want to take it away from him by constantly hovering over them like a nursemaid. My parents love me, but they don't need me as much as I once thought, or so I tell myself, to soothe the guilt that inevitably accompanies my craving for Peter, my perverse wish that he'd come and take me. I thought about it so often I can picture it like a movie in my head. I'll enter my apartment one day, and he'll be there. Big and dangerous, as lethal and beautiful as ever. He'll be there despite the police patrols outside, despite all of the feds' precautions. He'll be waiting to steal me away, and nothing I say will matter. That's probably the most shameful part of these fantasies, that I never have a choice in them, and that I like that. I want Peter to steal me away, to just come and take me over my objections. Then, and only then, Will I be able to live with the knowledge that I once again disappeared from the lives of the people who love and need me? That I abandoned my family, my patients, my bandmates, and my friends? I need Peter to be bad, so I can be at least somewhat good. I have to hate him in order to love him. I'm beginning to understand that about myself, to embrace the perversity within me. But what I don't understand is why I'm still here if he wants me. It can no longer be about my parents, so it must be about something else. Something he hasn't told me. I racked my brain for what it could be, and the best I can come up with is something he said when we were parting. I asked him if I'll be home until Mom recovers, and he started to say that he had to finish with something first as well. He didn't disclose what it was, though, nor so much as hint at how long that something would take. The only thing I can imagine being that important to him is his vengeance, but I don't know why that would keep him from me for so long. He was hunting Henderson when we were together, and according to the FBI, that's what he's still doing. 2 months ago, right after I got Peter's note, Ryson had brought me to their downtown office again. I nearly had a panic attack, thinking that the feds somehow learned about the note, but as it turned out, Ryson wanted to question me because Peter and his men struck again, interrogating 5 more U.S. citizens in their quest to uncover Henderson's whereabouts. "They were all in Charleston, South Carolina," Ryson told me. "Once again, Sokolov got in and out of the country undetected. We need to know how he's doing it, so we can stop him from wreaking havoc on people's lives."
"I'm sorry. I don't know anything about that," I said truthfully. Peter never spoke much about his connections or how he does the impossible things he does. As awful as I feel about the people he terrified and tortured, I know nothing that can help the feds in this regard. Assuming I wanted to help, that is. If Peter was unable to get into the U.S., he wouldn't be able to hurt more people. However, he also wouldn't be able to retrieve me, and that perverse, contradictory part of me, the one that keeps me awake at night, thinking of that note with a mixture of joy and trepidation, can't stand that possibility. I need him. I crave him so much it hurts. Before that note, I was able to hold the pain in, to be strong as I told myself that it was over. But hearing from Peter, knowing he'll be back, stripped away my fragile new defenses, plunging me back into that endless waiting mode. "Come back," I whisper, hugging a pillow to my chest as I stare at the TV screen. "Please, Peter, I need you. Come back for me and take me home."
Chapter 29, Peter. "You what?" Jan stares at me like I've sprouted a pair of tentacles. "I contacted Lucas Kint about arranging a meeting with Esquerra," I repeat, stirring the pasta sauce. "Hand me that basil, will you?" Jan doesn't move, so Ilya silently pushes the chopped basil toward me, and I sprinkle it liberally over the sauce. "I'm making Italian food tonight, a cuisine my men feel quite neutral about, but Sarah loves."
"For you, Petichka. So I feel like you're here with me."
I've started doing that this week, talking to her in my mind. It's probably not healthy, but it makes me feel closer to her, as though she's here with me instead of an ocean away. Maybe it's because I know I might see her soon, but I've been missing her even more than usual. Each day without her is fucking torture. "I thought you were going to kill Kent," Jan says, frowning in confusion. "For letting Sarah crash." "And I still might, just not at this time." I dip a long spoon into the sauce and taste it before adding a pinch more salt. "I need him to get me into a square's compound." Anton comes up to stand next to Jan.
"So that's your grand plan, to have Kint hand you on a silver platter to a square? You do remember the guy swore to kill you, right?" I give him a level look. "He won't kill me if he wants the name of Novak's asset."
"Ah," Jan's expression smooths out. "So you're going to pretend to double-cross Novak to gain access to Esquire's compound?"
Precisely. And then I'm going to double-cross him for real, I think. But I don't say it. As much as I trust my guys, I have to operate on the assumption that Novak has eyes and ears on us at all times. It's highly unlikely in the privacy of this safe house, but I can't afford to risk it. As it was, I barely managed to convince the Serbian to go along with my plan.
You're going to what?
He stood up, nearly knocking over the table when I informed him of my intentions in the cafe. In an instant, his goons appeared from their hiding place in the back, surrounding him like a human wall, their M16s drawn and pointed at me. So much for building trust, huh? I said, amused. And Novak gave me a dark glare before ordering them to stand down. I sat down and waited for him to do the same before explaining the gist of my plan. It took a while, but he finally understood why that was the only option. Why, even with his assets in place, we wouldn't be able to get into Esquerra's compound by force. Even if your pediatrician is a tech whiz who manages to disable the drones and the electric fences that protect the compound, we'll still have the guard towers to contend with. Which wouldn't be a problem for my team, except that Esquerra has generators and backup drones that would go online within a minute of the main ones being disabled. And then, while we're dealing with the drones firing on us from the sky, Esquerra's backup guards, over 100 of them, will appear and take us out. The only way past them would be with an even bigger force, say, a couple of 100 mercenaries of our own, but a group that size has no chance of getting near the compound undetected. We wouldn't even be able to enter Colombia without Esquerra hearing about it and intercepting us long before we get anywhere near his place.
So you plan to sacrifice my asset to gain Esquerra's trust?
Novak asked, frowning, and I nodded, explaining that once I'm in, it won't be all that difficult to get within grabbing distance of Nora. And once I have her as my hostage, I'll have leverage over Esquerra. He'll give up his life to save her. My men will be waiting just outside the compound, so once I have Nora and the baby, I'll disable the perimeter defenses myself and use the confusion of Esquerra's death to make our escape, I told Novak. It won't be easy, but it's the only chance we've got. The pasta sauce is finally ready, so as we sit down to eat dinner, I relay the same plan to the guys. No fucking way, Anton says when I'm done. Hostages or not, you're not going to walk out of that compound alive. You're talking about a suicide mission.
Not necessarily,
Jan says softly, winding his fork in the pasta. His green eyes hold a strange gleam.
Esquerra has a weakness now. His wife and daughter. And we're going to use it. Isn't that right?
Yes, exactly, I say, and remind myself to keep an eye on Jan during this mission. With everything so precariously balanced, the slightest unforeseen element, like one of my own double-crossing me, could bring it all crashing down. Chapter 30. Peter. The response from Lucas Kent comes almost immediately. He's willing to meet with me, which is the first step to getting near Esquerra. He proposes his wife's new restaurant in London as a potential meeting place. It's not exactly neutral ground, but I agree. I know what he's thinking. That this might be a ploy to lure him out, so I could punish him and his wife for fucking up with Sarah. Under other circumstances, he wouldn't have been wrong. The image of my Petichka in that hospital, her delicate face pale and bruised, still features in my nightmares. Someday Kent will pay for letting her escape and crash, but for now, I need him. He's my best shot at reaching out to Esquerra. Of course, if he turned me down, I had a backup plan. I know Nora Esquerra's email, having communicated in the past with her about my list. However, Esquerra is not exactly rational about his tiny wife and might take it the wrong way if I contact her after all these years. It's better to go through Kent. Esquerra might be more willing to listen in that case. Kint's wife, the beautiful Yulia, is nowhere in sight as I enter the stylish restaurant and make my way to a booth in the corner, where Kint's blonde head is visible above the partition. He stands up to greet me, his hard face wary as he extends his hand.
Sokolov?
I shake his hand, squeezing his fingers with slightly too much force.
Kint.
His eyes narrow, but he releases my hand without retaliating.
I didn't expect to hear from you again, he says as we take a seat and open the menus. How is your Sarah these days?
Who? Oh, that. I catch the waiter and tell him to bring me an unopened Guinness bottle with an opener on the side. Kint requests a cup of Earl Grey for himself. I wait for the waiter to leave before telling Kint. I have no idea how she is. I let her go last year and haven't seen her since. His eyebrows rise.
Really?
I shrug. What can I say? It was time.
Right.
He doesn't seem to believe me, but he turns his attention to the menu and scans it before looking up to ask,
Do you know what you want?
I'm not hungry, thanks. Given what happened with Sarah and what I'm about to tell him, I no longer trust Kint or the food in his wife's restaurant. His mouth curls in a dry smile.
I see.
Closing the menu, he waits for the waiter to set our drinks on the table and then says,
Why do you want to meet Esquerra? He still hasn't forgiven you for the incident with Nora, you know.
Yes, I'm aware. I used his wife as bait, letting her get kidnapped in order to find out where a terrorist group was holding him at the time. Back then, I knew he'd be pissed about Nora's involvement, but his rage didn't really make sense to me. After all, it was the only way to save his life. Now, however, I understand his reaction better. If anyone endangered Sarah like that, I wouldn't care about the reasoning behind it. My life for hers would never be a fair trade. I had a very lucrative offer come my way, I tell Kint, opening my Guinness. As a result, I've come into possession of some information Esquerra might appreciate. Kint frowns and picks up his cup of tea.
Oh, and what information is that?
There's a traitor in his compound, I say, and take a large swig as Kint's frown deepens. A traitor who's supposed to aid me in my assignment. Kint puts down his tea.
Someone hired you to carry out a hit on Esquerra.
At my confirming nod, he asks sharply,
Who?
I open my mouth to tell him, but he reaches the correct conclusion on his own.
Novak,
he spits out, pushing his tea away. His jaw flexes violently.
Of course. Who else would fucking dare?
I take another swig of my beer. 100 million euro is his offer, but I'm willing to let Esquerra match it if you bring me to Colombia to talk to him. I want bygones to be bygones. Well, that and 100 million, I clarify, lest he think I'm all about making peace. Kint stares at me, eyes narrowed.
You know he might not go for it, right? Now that we know there's a traitor, we'll figure out who that is. It's only a matter of time.
Sure, but time matters, especially when a vulnerable newborn is involved. Kint's face turns to stone.
What the fuck do you know about newborns?
His voice is dangerously soft.
Because if you're trying to imply that
Lizzie is in danger, I'm not implying, I'm telling you. Novak knows all about the recent addition to Esquerra's family, and he has plans for her. I'm taking a risk revealing so much, but I can't afford to pussyfoot around. I have to get Esquerra to listen to me. My future with Sarah depends on it. The waiter approaches to take our order, but Kint shoos him away with a curt wave.
What if Esquerra just wires the 100 million to you?
He asks, picking up his tea again.
100 million for a name, all at zero risk to you.
No go, I say and finish my beer.
I don't need to spend the rest of my life looking over my shoulder, waiting for Esquera to carry out his revenge on me. He either hears me out in person, or I take the job. It's up to him.